over to you, Lord Min. Can you introduce yourselves and talk us through?
Good afternoon, Honourable Chairperson, Mr. Ray Gowen, distinguished members of the Parliament and Portfolio Committee of Mineral Resources, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to commend you, first of all, for creating this opportunity to hear what's actually happening at the rock face. I think it'll be very useful to you. But firstly, introduce myself. My name is Ian Farmer. I've been with Lonro and Lonmin now for some 25 years, 50% of that time in London and about 50% in Southern Africa. I've been in the PGM industry for 16 years now, and the last 3 years chief executive. I'm based in our head office in Johannesburg. Today I'm joined by a few members of my team. I have Karishma Subasad on my side here, who's a senior manager in our business development and marketing team. I have Ruli Diseko over here, who's a manager in the marketing team as well. And I have Abby Cockler there, who's executive manager, head of human resources, particularly involved in community work. And at the far end, I have an executive vice president, my exco, Natasha Fullion. All the information I'm going to present to you now is based on the 30th September year-end results, and it's perhaps more up-to-date than the information you've had from other presentations from the industry. I want to start the presentation by briefly introducing Lonmin as a company and explaining some of the unique attributes of platinum group metals. And then I'll move on and I'll specifically discuss, hopefully in a balanced way, some of the challenges that are posed by today's investment climate and Lonmin's transformation progress and future employment creation opportunities in our company. I think you'll find our presentation a little different from those of my colleagues have already presented, and perhaps somewhat more strategic in content. I think the presentation should last only about 20 minutes, and after that perhaps take any questions you might have. First of all, Lonmin is the world's third largest producer of platinum. We have significant low-cost reserves, and we're situated in the world's primary PGM producing area. We are listed on the London Stock Exchange, and we're a member of the FTSE 100. We're also listed in Johannesburg, we're a top 40 member. We're a member of the ICMM, that's the International Council for Mining and Metallurgy, which sets good standards for sustainability in the industry. And we're actually listed as a FTSE for Good Index member, which means we're recognised in London for our sustainability standards. Our operating assets and our headquarters are based here in South Africa, with Marikana being our main asset, with concentrating, smelting and refining capacity. We're located some 100 kilometres west of Pretoria on the Western Limit Bushveld Complex. We have other assets in the portfolio, development assets in the form of reserves called Pandora, Limpopo and Akonani. Over the last 5 years, we've invested some $1.3 billion in growing our operations, and we should continue to invest at around a rate of $400 million per annum going forward. We currently employ 27,000 full-time employees. Platinum mining is a very labour-intensive business. We also have approximately 9,500 contractors working with us at this point in time. Those numbers have increased from around 22,000 full-time employees in 2009, so 5,000 jobs created in the last 2 years. Our shareholder base is largely international. Only some 19% of our shares are held here in South Africa, the rest of them held all over the world. With Xstrata being a 25% shareholder in our company. Shanduka is our black economic empowerment partner through the Inkwala structure. At Lonmin, our values underpin our culture. We've included some reference to our values in the back of the pack under the appendix. We generated some $2 billion of export earnings during 2011, as shown in the pie chart here on the left. Some 90% of this money remains in South Africa, and employees, being labour-intensive, share the largest share. The vast majority of the inputs and the capital we also source are also sourced locally. On the right-hand side, you can see the average dividend yield earned by an investor in our company over the last 10 years is 2.7%. In the last 3 years, it's been very little, with zero dividend being paid in 2008 and 2009. Indeed, we raised some $250 million in the London market as a new capital investment by way of a rights issue in 2009 to strengthen the company's business here in South Africa. South Africa's Bushveld complex is unique in the world for its PGM metals and associated minerals. The term PGMs refers to platinum, palladium, rhodium, ruthenium, and iridium. But we also mine nickel, copper, and chrome. All these metals are actually contained in the same ore. Some 25% of South Africa's mineral revenues comes from PGMs, and South Africa controls around 78% of the world's platinum supply and 42% of the world's palladium supply. PGMs is clearly a sunrise industry. With competent stewardship of the PGMs, there will be a source of wealth creation for the country for many decades to come. By comparison to most commodities, they are rare metals. Future supply competitors for South Africa are Zimbabwe and the recycling market. And reliability of supply is seen as vital by our customers due to the niche and highly specialized use of these metals in high-tech consumer goods. The most important use of PGMs is the autocatalyst, which is fitted into exhaust systems in vehicles to convert noxious fumes into harmless gases. Platinum is best suited to diesel engines, which are popular in Europe, while palladium is better suited to gasoline engines, which are popular in the US, China, and the rest of the world. Jewelry has been successfully developed over the past two decades through South African industry cooperation. But it's a fickle demand element. It's fashion-driven and very price-sensitive. Other demand comes from chemical catalysis and electronics. Palladium demand in autocatalysts has grown far faster than platinum over the last 20 years, largely due to its lower price. And platinum supply has been tight, particularly since the 2008 Eskom power disruption. Whereas platinum, however, has been freely available and sold from Russian stockpiles since the 1990s. Palladium provides other benefits, one of them being the reduced need for rhodium. Over the last 4 or 5 years, palladium has benefited largely from much better sales of gasoline cars in the US and China versus rather lackluster sales of diesel vehicles in Europe. The car companies are constantly trying to use less PGMs and to change the mix of the metals to reduce their costs. We believe the autocatalyst market will be around for a long time to come, as automakers will continue to rely on the internal combustion engine for the foreseeable future. However, there are many threats which may reduce the unit consumption for the size of engine. And also a major threat is the electrification or electric vehicle. The pure electric car is probably the largest threat of all, as it contains no platinum group metals whatsoever. Hybrid cars still have some form of internal combustion engine on board, and hence they also have a need for a catalyst still. Higher vehicle sales volumes offset smaller quantities of metal used in the cars, and in the longer term, the fuel cell has a particularly strong probability of succeeding. But this technology risks being smothered if the electric car gets enough support to be mass-produced. In the short and medium term, we expect the strong growth from stationary fuel cells to be a valuable demand element, and these products are being sold quite extensively in the Far East already. This next slide is quite important. It shows that unit costs for the South African platinum sector have risen at a compound annual growth rate of 21% in the last 8 years. Falling grades in deeper mines have contributed to some extent to this, but rising labour and electricity costs have recently become even larger contributors. The platinum sector requires continual capital reinvestment. This slide clearly illustrates that there's been almost no free cash flow generated by the sector for the last 3 years. And periods of constrained cash lead to underinvestment in growth and supply shortages, resulting in price spikes which incentivize substitution and can damage long-term demand. Moving on now. In his recent speech to Parliament, the Minister of Finance outlined many challenges faced by the mining industry. These include uncertainty around mining right regulations, logistical and infrastructure challenges, low investment in electricity generation, the nationalisation debate, and exchange rate volatility. I will concur with his observations. Lomond has itself experienced over the last 12 to 18 months violent strikes and violent community unrest. We've also made international headlines as the security and tenure of our mineral rights was threatened by parties exploiting ambiguities in the law. This has been very reputationally damaging to my company and to the country. In addition, the nationalisation debate is particularly harmful to the company's reputation when all evidence and international experience points to disastrous consequences from such a policy for the country. Perceptions of increased country risk and the increased cost of capital will in turn reduce investment, thereby risking the chances of a growth-driven employment-creating recovery being successful. Longman was the first PGM mining company to be awarded a new order mining right in 2006. We are fully committed to transformation. Our shareholders support it, our board supports it. A transformation subcommittee of the board exists, chaired by Cyril Ramaphosa, which oversees delivery. And here's a snapshot of Longman's transformation scorecard as it currently stands. We tend to use the traffic light system here to colour red, amber and green. Red being high risk, green being all okay and going well, amber with some caution. On this chart we show the results of our 2011 year and our targets for 2012 and 2014. We are regularly audited by the DMR and we audit ourselves by KPMG for external assurance purposes. Plans underpin each of your scorecard elements. In the next few slides, I'll deal with each one of these areas in more detail. I'll cover what's working well, but I'll also cover what's not working well, which I think my colleagues this morning can do. Transformation is not a box-ticking exercise. This is a journey we're on together, and it'll go beyond 2014. Firstly, ownership. As you can see from this slide of the Longman share price, a PGM producer's share price is highly volatile. Our share price peaked at £43 in 2007, but it bottomed at just £5 in 2008. 18% of our primary assets are currently owned by Shanduka via the Impala structure. In July of this year, our original employee participation scheme distributed some 198 million rands to some 22,000 of our employees. And a roadmap has been submitted to the DMR setting out how we intend to get from here to 26%. This will include participation of community and employees. And we're currently working with the Premier's office in an attempt to resolve leadership disputes among the Baba Bamakhali people so we can facilitate this. Overall, HGSA representation across all management levels is progressing well. It's at 32%, excluding white women. And it's important that you note there are different ways to report these statistics. We are reporting them on the way that reflects us in the worst light, which excluding white women. Also, I'd like to stress that these all have to be merit-based appointments in our company. Significant progress has been achieved at junior management levels, where we need to generate a pipeline for future middle and senior management. And this will realize results over time. Senior technical management positions are, of course, the most challenging due to the number of years' experience required and the skill shortages that exist, particularly in these disciplines. Job hopping and poaching of HGSA candidates from each other is a real risk, and further cost escalation will naturally be the natural consequences. Women in mining is a key challenge. We've made significant progress over the last few years in respect of creating and enabling environment for women in Longman. The key challenge, however, remains the high failure rate regarding physical requirements relative to men. In 2011, we completed a comprehensive and integrated review of our human resource development chain. Our spend in this area is around 200 million rands per annum, and this goes beyond our SLP commitments. Our community education program has shown an encouraging improvement in grade 12 pass rates, evidenced by our community schools achieving an overall pass rate in excess of the national average in 2010. As a result of our investment in this education, 40% of our new bursary intake in 2012 will come from the local community, a remarkable achievement given the past few years' experience. We've actually not had that sort of success. Our investment in community education is aligned to a critical skills pipeline development, and during 2012 we'll establish an artisan college on our property. We have created a local recruitment program for entry-level mining jobs through a mining-related skills program, and we've recently employed some 643 local Baba Bamakhali community members. Moving on now to housing, our hostel conversion project has made good progress. There's no risk in not achieving the 2014 target of 100% conversion of our hostel blocks. We'll spend some 300 million rands over the next 3 years to achieve this. In addition, a pool of funds amounting to 25 million rand is available to fund a continuous expansion of our housing program. But the provision of mass affordable housing remains a major challenge, and we continue to evaluate new approaches to try and make this affordable. community development program has been developed in consultation with all stakeholders. Whilst progress has been achieved, visibility and sustainability of projects remains challenging. Capacity constraints in local municipalities often delay the implementation of basic services like water and sanitation and infrastructure development projects. Projects not requiring municipal approval, such as education and health, are more successful due to the responsiveness of these departments. As part of our endeavour to increase visibility and impact, we've significantly increased the community development budget in 2012, and this will be used to accelerate delivery of high-impact employment-creating projects through our SLP obligations. Our BE procurement spend exceeds the target set by the Mining Charter. In 2011, the spend was 4.3 billion rands, or 45% of our total spend, versus 2.9 billion the year before. Although this is excellent performance, we're not satisfied with our spend on 100% black-owned companies, which is only 4.7% of that, or 448 million rands for the year. Loman also aims to increase the black-owned spend in the communities, which is currently only 1.5% of the total. We provide development assistance to SMMEs, but this program has had only limited success. Beneficiation. In mid-2006, Loman were integrally involved in the establishment of a Platinum Beneficiation Committee. This was a partnership with the DMR, in which we as an industry appointed industry experts and were commissioned to do an in-depth study of downstream and upstream beneficiation opportunities. I understand that opportunities identified through these studies have underpinned the DMR's thinking regarding the current BE beneficiation strategy being discussed. A particular success story is the autocatalyst industry in Port Elizabeth, and Lomman last year shipped 16% of its product to catalytic converter manufacturers in South Africa. Going forward, the creation of an enabling environment, coordinating industrial policy, trade, tax, skills development policy, etc., is fundamentally important if beneficiation is to work in South Africa. So in summary, this last slide I think should be quite interesting for you. I think generally we're in good shape and we should achieve most of our transformation goals on the good foundation we laid out over the last few years. What we've tried to do here is colour code what things are working well, what things we need to be a little bit cautious about, and what things remain particularly challenging. And I would say the success and visibility of accelerated community development projects is fundamentally important. Success here is to an extent dependent on municipalities, but also to an extent dependent on tribal authorities, also being able to contribute to the governance process involved. The most challenging transformation areas are firstly the affordability of individual home ownership, employment equity in the form of representation at top management, and women in mining. Those are the three areas which we're really going to actually be challenged to meet the targets. We do support government's approach to beneficiation. We think it's being tackled correctly. Successful implementation, however, will depend on the integrated enabling policy framework I referred to earlier. So in conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, the investment climate we're operating in, both internationally and domestically, impacts our ability to be successful on both the transformation and job creation front. Put simply, if the economics aren't there, we won't be successful. A volatile socio-political environment creates uncertainty, and this erodes shareholder confidence. Transformation is a journey, and while we're making steady progress, challenges do remain, and pushing ahead in an imprudent manner would be inadvisable and will once again impact commercial viability, and therefore make our ability to ultimately invest and grow and create jobs more difficult. To maximise the PGM industry's contribution to South Africa over the long term, we need stability and predictability, and it does feel like we have neither of these at present. By working together, we can address these issues, and we can do better. Demand for platinum will grow by some 50% over the next decade. South Africa needs to be competitive if it is to exploit this opportunity. The industry has the ability to create new employment, both in the form of direct and indirect jobs, and Loman will do its share. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
such a loanmen, and honorable members, there you've got the loanmen presentation. I'm not too clear in terms of your job creation initiatives. I might be reading your presentation incorrectly, but it doesn't come out clearly where and how many jobs are you looking at creating by what time. Can you just clarify us on that? Then I'll allow the honorable members to engage with your presentation.
Thank you. We are a growing company. Our job creation has gone from 22,000 to 27 over the last 3 years, so we are heading in the good direction from that perspective. We should create a further full-time 2,000 jobs over the next 3 years as we get to what we think is our optimum capacity. That, of course, is direct full-time jobs. As you grow, you do use more contractors. Those are contractors largely working on capital projects who are specialists. Those will grow too. It's difficult to give an exact number on that issue. We're also looking at our community development spend and trying to reorientate the spend, the additional spend we're allocating from next year onwards to projects that actually create jobs in the local community. For example, a number of new roads are required in our area around some of the township areas, and those are projects we can sponsor, which obviously do create jobs as well.
All right, honourable members, there you are. I'll come back later. Honourable Lucas, I see your hand. Take the platform for now. Honourable Vigane.
On page 5, in that graph with the dividend, there's a sharp increase in 2008 and then a rapid descent in 2009. What was the cause of that? And then the other one is that I'm so pleased to hear that you're having the catalytic converters manufactured in locally. And do you all export them?
Shall I take the questions one at a time?
Note them and then respond thereafter.
Chairperson, can I request first of all that the presenter gives us that detailed copy that he has for us to make copies, because if we had that information, then we would have a better way of engagement. The booklet that you gave us was, you at least gave us on time, even if it was a short space of time, but there's a lot more going on that paper there in front of me. It would have helped if I had it in front of me. Then, Chairperson, I don't know, on page 4, they appear to be a very strong company if I look at the international partnership, or the company as a whole seems to be stronger outside of the country than inside the country. But I'm sure in terms of money, there's a lot more they could do. Hence, I want to ask if I see that the last point says Shanduka is our Black Economic Empowerment partner through INCWALA. Now, do they feel that this is enough in terms of meeting their being BE compliant? Because with that size of a company, you could be of much bigger value if you had more BE companies than if this is the only company that it reflects. And I just wonder if you do meet the threshold in terms of the BE company expectation in terms of compliance. Then, Chair, on page the women in mining, on page 14, or let's rather say the historically disadvantaged, you indicated that in terms of status, we indicated with color codes. But I must also say here too, once again, Chairperson, it doesn't really give us a picture of how effective or by how much are you progressing or improving in terms of actually keeping up to employment equity requirements. And when you say you are excluding white women in what you are mentioning here, would it then give us a true reflection of how you are meeting the relevant needs in terms of historically disadvantaged communities around your mines. It would then give me a doubt in terms, I don't think to us, in true honesty, it's so much relevant, the exclusion of white women, more than it would be relevant to say how many of these women, especially black women, are in high positions in management, senior management positions, vis-a-vis the, and even those white women who are there, what positions are they holding, to try and have a good comparison in terms of previously black or previously disadvantaged communities, and the very white women, because we must try and determine if we are able then to meet the needs in terms of you at least keeping up with our own country's needs in terms of black women. Then page 15, Chair, I don't know how old is the company. I maybe missed that if it was information given. But I tend to be sensitive when it comes to wedding, especially if somewhere along the line you are going to be saying a will, as though something hasn't started happening. It's still about to happen. I'm referring to the community education where you say bursary allocations will be from the greater Lomnin community. It's as if you are saying to us, if we are to ask for your social labor plan, for example, you don't have one. You are about to start. Are you about to start because we've called you in, or is it a commitment that has been there within the company to say that it was a long-standing time, but you don't have anything to can say that it is really happening, and we need, you know, to see it more. It must be clearly demonstrated. Then, also in terms of your artisans, I think you said something, in terms of the critical skills plan, planning to launch an artisan college in 2012, is this on your own, or is it in partnership with government, and is it identifying the actual needs of that particular area that you are going to have this implemented? And Chair, with the size of what I'm determining from this company, when it comes to issues of, you mentioned somewhere in some of the pages what you do or what you produce. Yes, we're an international company, but to what extent are you trying to meet our own South African needs in terms of ensuring that more is produced within the country? And I'm sure you are aware we are one of the greatest platinum holders in the world.
70%.
So you should be one company that should be proving to us right now that the communities around you and the actual people who are working for you are one of the most developed and richest communities you can find because of that platinum. So if, for one, you are saying to me that you are exporting more than holding within the country, then I would ask the question, then where is your commitment in terms of our own social plans? To what extent have you developed when it comes to that? Then, I asked this question to Anglo as well. I'm asking it to you again because they didn't really answer me. I'm noticing that on page 17, you are also mentioning your community development project. Now, I normally have a challenge in the sense that a lot that government does is also a free service. But you never seem to indicate as to how much is there in terms of partnership with government, so that one can get an indication as to what extent are you really contributing in community development rather than perhaps riding on government because coincidentally there's a clinic in an area that you're working in. So what I'm trying to say is that when you say there's a build and upgrade of clinics and there's mobile clinics, there's ambulances, I could argue with you and say to you, government also has that. So how can you then demonstrate to us that this is solely from you in trying to give some form of contribution and improved lifestyle to a particular community beyond what government is doing for us to can see that our own communities are benefiting out of that? So once things are thrown like that, then one doesn't seem to understand, is this now really finance that comes from you, yourself as a company, or are you also just collecting data and stats and credits on behalf of government? And then, I see that areas of improvement, which says to me that somewhere, somehow you have a gap. I just have a problem with the fact that when we received this, it was summary. You did try to read there, but as it is now, I've already lost some information that I want from that paper of yours. But in any case, you say procurement spent on 100% bank-owned companies was only 4.7%, or that amount of money. Is it what the company could afford, or is it what the company should have been obligated to spend? Because then I would want to know, these black-owned companies, are they around the mining area? Because once again, we have the constant experience that physically when you go to these areas, there's a lot of poverty around the mining companies that are there, and we have a challenge of saying, normally with international companies, you'll find that your way of employing, you might say black people, so many people, but might not necessarily be South African citizens. It's more of people from outside the country, and we want to know about our own people, how are our own people actually benefiting out of that. And is the reason because there's no capacity, or there's no people around the area, or whatever your decision is that you make, which is also still a challenge to us. Thank you, Chair.
Yes. Let's give you all the questions so that you can be able to respond to us in a comprehensive way. Mm-hmm. Firstly, on the ownership structure, I think the question has been asked whether you have only Shanduka as your BEE, and who is Shanduka? Surely there's a big chunk of that company that belongs to Glencore. Is it truly BEE? Can you claim that is BEE? So I think here we were looking for more information that would enable us to then get to where, for instance, you can talk about, Mr. Ramaphosa. Fair enough. But then who is in partnership with that has formed Shanduka? Would that reflect you as having been BEE compliant? Or you are still lagging far behind, if that's the only BEE partner you have in your ownership structure? Secondly, what about your ESOPs? Do your employees participate in any way in the shareholding of the company and therefore standing a chance of participating in the dividends? Now, you would need to give us more information to unpack really your transformation information. For instance, in as the Honorable Member has asked, in page 14, you're not giving us details in terms of how many people occupy executive positions, and the same question that we have asked, whether do they have the powers that go with those positions? Because to us, it's a very important, aspect. The other matter that we want you to demonstrate to us, is we see that you have an investment in within the country, and your primary listing is at the London Stock Exchange, but in your documents you are not. Your capital investment in South African operations is $1.3 billion, translating to what? Something like 8 billion rand in the last 5 years. Now, we would want to know in terms of the future, demonstrating your commitment into the country, how much investment is Lonmin looking at injecting, into your operations within the country? And of course, our request that you basically provide us with some details. I'm not going to repeat what other honorable members have raised, but on slide number 11, you are raising challenges that are facing you. The first challenge is your socio-political environment, youth and community frustration, and nationalization. But what you are not saying to us is, what strategies are you working on to respond to those challenges? For instance, we've asked you a direct question in terms of job creation initiatives that are targeting youth. You're reflecting the frustration by the youth community. Indeed, this is what we're busy trying to find out from a number of companies. What is it that is being plowed back to those communities, given our own experience in terms of oversight visits that we have undertaken across the country? And we have made no bones about it, about the fact that what we have discovered on the ground is abject poverty engulfing the mining community, people who are residing within the close proximity of the mines. And indeed, these frustrations that you are raising here are therefore as a result of what we also have picked up. But on this debate of nationalization, what we have been seeing the industry's response to be is to tell the public how bad nationalization is without providing an alternative to the call for nationalization. Because the primary mover of reasons for call for nationalization is because, firstly, there's a perception out there that there's lack of transformation within the mining industry. Secondly, communities are not benefiting. The primary communities being the mine communities and South Africa as a whole, they are not deriving benefits except through taxes that you pay and royalties that you pay into the general fiscus. But people have nothing to show for the wealth, the mineral wealth that we have in this country. So instead of ending only at raising concerns and negative impacts that nationalization could have, what alternatives are you going to put in place that would then demonstrate to the people of this country that here we are exploiting minerals, which are a common heritage of all South Africans, and here this is the way and the manner in which you are going to benefit. This is the way and manner in which you are going to make contribution to deal with the socio-economic backlash that we have inherited since 1994. We are now approaching 20 years. And indeed, the element of political stability in the country is measured within that time frame. If people believe that democracy has not yielded the expected results, after 20 years, they start to raise quite serious questions. In our situation, before we clock 20 years, they are starting to raise those serious questions. That's why you hear some calls being made. So I'm saying you are doing quite a sterling work as the mining industry in a number of, every day these days, when you open a newspaper, a mining company is debating nationalization of mines, how bad it is. But what I always miss is what is the alternative to this nationalization, because you won't win this debate by just showing how bad it is. You would win it if you show how bad, but at the same time, you put in place an alternative that would address the needs. And I'm happy that you have raised it in your own documents, and hence we are putting that challenge out to you so that you are in a position to deal with. Well, the other issues that you are raising are in the process of being addressed, the infrastructure, your transport, your ambiguity in the laws. The department is busy with amendments to the MPRDA. You will get an opportunity to come and address us on the specifics on the legislative framework that you believe are the impediment to your progress. And indeed, on page 16. In terms of your hostel conversion, you are saying 47% of hostel blocks converted into bachelor and family units. The 68 remaining blocks will be converted by 2014. I don't know whether this 68 represent the 53%. And how long have you taken to convert the 47%? And therefore, is your target convincing that with the remaining period to 2014, you'll be able to do the majority of your hostels, single-sex hostels that are remaining? Because in terms of your own figures here, the majority of your hostels still remain unrehabilitated, unconverted. And therefore, it raises a question in terms of the ability for you to can be able to. Again, please provide us with some more detailed information on your procurement spend. Because here you are just putting, you know, figures in terms of financial year, you know, 2011, the spend was 4.3 billion. We don't know in which areas have you spent that. Was it on capital goods? Was it on consumer goods? Was it on services? What is it that has been spent on? So that we are able to then comprehend with the information that you have given us. Now, on page 20, again, in relation to home ownership, you say on housing and living conditions, you have serious challenge on the promotion of home ownership. Is this not a contradiction? Because on one hand, you are pushing high targets in terms of the conversion of your hostels into family unit and single accommodation arrangement. I don't know, even though you didn't say here, what is your target in terms of occupancy rate of your converted, you know, hostels. But then here you seem to be saying to us that people don't want to own homes, which you'd clarify it, because I pick it up as a contradiction. And again, in one of the challenges in terms of your employment equity, you're saying you've got a challenge in F-band and women in mining targets. Why would this be a challenge? Would this be a challenge? Because over this whole period, you are given an opportunity to produce, first and foremost, the requisite skills through training. You've shown us here that you have offered, you know, learnerships to people. Are you not following up on those skills that you assisted to create, so that then you don't get faced with this challenge of not having, you know, people to can be able to fill the positions that you want filled? Now we have in our own research understanding that you are sitting on the sum of about 5 million rand of the social and labor plan projects in Northwest that you have not spent, or you have suspended at one stage. You have suspended the program of expenditure at one stage or the other. Can you clarify us on that? Because as we have indicated before, that some of the expenditure on social and labor plans should have a spin-off of job creation as one of the elements that we pick up. But now, if you sit on large sums of amounts which are earmarked for social and labor plans, or for that matter, for your social investment, it means we are retarding progress in terms of job creation possibilities that could arise if that money has been spent. So if you can respond to those, and yes, if there are any follow-ups, honorable members will ask you so those questions. Please respond.
Thank you, Chairman. I'll start at the beginning and see if I can recall all the points that were made. First of all, the dividend drop in 2008-2009.
I will save my questions for when you come back.
Sorry. First of all, the dividend drop in the 2008-2009 period, that was a direct result of the credit crunch period. You recall at the time the platinum price fell from about $1,900 to below $1,000. It just plummeted. And that was a result of the crisis in the auto industry. You recall in North America when General Motors and Ford and Chrysler were in such serious trouble. So that was a very, very difficult time for our industry. And indeed, at that time, we actually had to lay off employees. We had to close down high-cost ounces. We, in fact, shrank our office in London. We cut the size of the board. We cut the size of our management team. We had to take some quite drastic actions, effectively, to keep the company viable through that period. So that was a very traumatic period for platinum producers, 2008, 2009, and shareholders received nothing during that period. And indeed, you may recall I mentioned that we actually had a rights issue to raise money in the London market to actually keep the company solvent, which was pumped into South Africa during that period. So it was very difficult for us. The next point was around my notes. These are my speaking notes, if you like. I'm happy to, what I would suggest, Chairman, is that we answer these questions in written form, and I can repeat the figures and the details and written notes in those answers. These are kind of speaking notes rather than written in a way that would make sense on a standalone basis. In terms of our shareholding, our origins of the company are British. We are not a South African company. We were floated in the UK in 1909. We're a 102-year-old company. And Lonro was the origin of the company that we are today. And some of you may recall the name Lonro as a company ran by a chap called Tiny Rowland. So I worked for the company during that period. And it spun off all the other assets to become a Focus Mining Company only about 15 years ago. So we've gone through a fairly evolutionary process. So the history of the company is British, which is why most of our shares are held internationally and with the most liquid share on the London Stock Exchange in the platinum sector. 18% of our South African assets are owned by Nkwala, by Shanduka, and I'm sure that Shanduka would argue with you, Chairman, quite vociferously that they are a black economic empowerment company with more than 50% of their shares in black hands. Yes, 18% is not enough. We need to get to 26% by 2014. That's something we're working on. We have submitted to the DMR a concept paper as to how we get there. And a majority of that remaining equity stake will come from broad-based schemes in one form or another of our employees and our communities. We are in dialogue at the moment with various parties to explore the best way to construct an ESOP, a new ESOP. Bearing in mind there have been some headlines on ESOPs that haven't worked well, we want to avoid those pitfalls. And we're also quite keen to do an employment ownership scheme, a community ownership scheme in the area in which we operate. And we would like to work with the Bapa Bamakhali tribe, who are the indigenous people around our operations. And we're in dialogue with the Premier's office over the leadership structure of that tribe, which is currently going through a problematic period. In terms of women in mining and employment equity generally, there are two ways numbers can be quoted, with women, white women and without them. If you add white women in, opposite targets are easier to meet. If you take them out, they're more difficult. Personally, I think the objective of all of us here is to transformation is only complete when the workforce reflects the demographics of the population as a whole. So this 40% target by 2014, in my view, is an interim step. It is not the end goal. And that, I think, is our objective. If you include white women, we're at 43% in total. If you take them out, we're at 32%, so we have some way to go. We have women right from the executive level down. I have an exco consisting of six people only, of which two are women, one of which is sat here on our far left. Natasha Bloom runs our processing division, and if you'd like her to answer about her executive power, because she might feel somehow that she doesn't have the full power of her position, she can quite capably speak for herself, I can assure you. Community education. Community education is something we have been investing in for a number of years. This has been a journey where AB is in fact responsible for this area of the business. And the point I was making about we will be recruiting from the local community 40% of the bursars for next year, we consider that a real milestone, because when we started this exercise a number of years ago, there just weren't a sufficient number of matric candidates with the right caliber to actually meet our bursary minimum standards. So the fact that we've been putting money into local schools to not only upgrade the infrastructure, not only provide feeding, but to actually help educate the teachers, the educators as you call them, to provide science lab, provide computer lab. We've also provided extra math and science lessons after school, but that's been going on for a number of years, and we're now starting to see the fruits of that labour because the average matric results are now better than the national average, and the number of matriculants that are actually capable of qualifying for bursaries and taking on some of the core skills that we need to train people in, the engineering disciplines, quite frankly, which require quite stringent entry requirements, that's the area where we're quite pleased. When we say we will be doing that, it's because we're investing throughout an integrated train of events to try and get to that point. It's taken us some years to get there, but we're very pleased with the results we've had. The Artisan College is another extension of that, because up until press, we've actually been using the Artisan Colleges, the historical ones run by other people. So we would have our own couple of hundred people at any one time who were artisans, and we would pack them off down to Velcom or whatever, and they'll sit through other people's schools. But we're now starting to try and increase the numbers. In fact, we want to double the numbers, and that's going to require our own training facilities, which we're working on with the training authorities to get them accredited as we speak. In terms of the beneficiation area, you're right. The auto catalyst manufacturing centre that's been established in Port Elizabeth is indeed a success story, and some 16% of our material is sold locally into that industry. It's an industry that not only services the local requirement for auto catalysts, but it also exports them, and indeed it has quite a large international market share. The industry has been incentivized through a special tax incentive scheme that's in place for the motor industry, and that's worked extremely well. That scheme is actually up for review in 2013, and there is some disquiet about whether it's going to continue to be as effective in the future. But another industry can tell you about that little challenge. In terms of our development projects, yes, we do work in partnership with government. As I mentioned, we have a good working relationship with the Department of Education and Department of Health. So the projects we work on are done in partnership with them. Yes, we do spend our money, but we consult with those departments about where that money can be spent most effectively, because of course they have a development plan for the region. We want to make sure that the money we're spending actually increases the overall result, not something on the side that actually doesn't actually help the national interest. So we do that planning in coordination with those departments. So things like building the clinics, resurfacing the clinics, providing ambulances, they are all things that the local government have agreed we should do, and they've endorsed them, but we've paid for them. And that's a fairly good working relationship. Indeed, that goes further because, of course, there are other companies in the area, and what needs to happen is those companies need to do things to make sure the jigsaw puzzle fits together and makes a nice picture. You don't want every company doing their own thing and they're not actually speaking to each other and coordinating activities. So that works well. The area where we have a challenge is, in fact, the projects which require local municipal assistance, because we find that the local municipality is often something that holds us back, quite frankly. And the 5 million shortage that we've underspent last year is because that's money reserved for water reticulation projects where we can't get the municipality to give us the approvals we need and to do their end of the project. So that's something that falls under Avi, and he can answer in more detail if you'd like to hear more. In terms of the procurement spend, yes, we can give all the detail you require on that. We have a lot of breakdown on that. As I say, the overall spend levels are doing well. In fact, we had the DMR at our offices just last week, and the DMR audited all these things. And the DMR actually were taking our numbers and phoning our suppliers and checking their credentials to make sure we weren't fiddling the numbers. So there's a lot of work going on in this area. The challenging part, of course, is, as I mentioned, is the 100% black-owned businesses are not as big a percentage as we'd like, and the local community companies are not as big as we'd like. One of the difficulties we have is that being only 100 kilometres from Johannesburg, it's very difficult for these small startup companies to compete with somebody who's already established in Johannesburg. So for local companies, that's a little bit of an impediment. In terms of ESOPs, we paid out 198 million rand this year under our original ESOP scheme. That went to 22,000 of our workforce. It was shared between them on the basis, similar to the De Beers guy described earlier, on a sort of a number of years they would have worked for the company.
Did they receive how much?
198 million rand paid out in June of this year.
June just this year.
And it worked out.
How much per person?
It worked out to about, on average, about 8,000 rand a person.
What?
8,000 rand.
Eight.
No. 8 with 3 zeros. Just 8. So, of course, ESOP schemes are a function of share prices. And you heard from our colleagues at Kumba how the iron ore share prices have absolutely skyrocketed, and employees have benefited from that. But you've seen the platinum share price has not. It did skyrocket in 2008, but it fell like a stone in 2009. So ESOPs are a function of how the markets move. And when you do invest in companies in shares, in equity, it is somewhat of a roulette table sometimes. And that's the way it worked out. But it was very well received by our employees, and it was the payout was worked on in coordination with NUM, who were very helpful. In terms of future investment, Chairman, you asked about that. We are currently producing just over 700,000 ounces of platinum and associated metals. We intend to grow our capacity to around 950,000 ounces of platinum and associated metals by around 2015. Now, obviously, our ability to grow at that pace will depend on our ability to generate cash, because you can't invest money you haven't got. That will create employment over that time frame, and it'll cost us somewhere in the region of about 3 billion rand a year of new investment. In terms of the socio-political challenges we're facing and what are we doing, it's a very good question to ask, and this is in some ways a pioneering area. In terms of our relationship with our employees, we actually have a good working relationship with the NUM. We have a long track record of them of no disputes. However, in May of this year, we had at one of our operations called the Karim Mine, we actually had an internal union dispute result in a strike which lasted around 10 days. And the only way that strike was broken ultimately was by us firing 9,000 people and then rehiring most of them back again. And you can imagine that's quite traumatic business to go through. The root cause of the strike was actually NUM trying to root out corruption in their own branch within our business. And in rooting out that corruption, the corrupt officials basically intimidated the workforce to go out on strike. So it was a very unfortunate business, quite frankly, for all concerned, and very expensive for the company. But now that's behind us, I think that gives us the chance to actually rebuild, if you like, the relationship with the union at that part of the business. In terms of local communities, we've also had community unrest in the form of turning over cars, burning tyres, that sort of thing. Fortunately, nobody was hurt. And this has, as a root cause, unemployment of youth in the region in which we operate. And as a result of that incident, we have established a forum called the Bakoba Mokgali Development Team. That's right. We meet with them every second week. We have recruited some 600 youth from the local vicinity. But you have to ask yourself, you know, could we have avoided that predicament? And unfortunately, communities are often very difficult to manage because the leadership thereof is very fragmented and not particularly formalised. And that's been a struggle we've had in the past. And indeed, this incident, I think, has created a platform where we can actually have a better dialogue and focus on real issues. So I think we can hopefully build on something out of this situation. Poverty around the mines, yes, Chairman, that is a challenge for the country and for us as an industry, because of course when a new mine starts up it is a centre of wealth, and not only do you have the local people that have always lived in that area, but you immediately have an influx of other people looking to try and piggyback or exploit the wealth that this mine brings. So it can often result in informal settlements bringing up an increase in crime and that sort of thing, and that's something we have to all manage very carefully. You ask about nationalisation and what's the alternative. We're all very much aware of the inequality that exists in this country, and we're all very much aware of the need for transformation and the need for visibility in terms of changing the demographics of the country and sharing the wealth more fairly and more evenly. However, to do that, not only do we need to take the existing cake, if you like, and share it fairly, but we also need to make sure that the cake rapidly grows. And far be it from me to talk about the job of government, but that the government needs not only to make sure that the cake is fairly distributed, but the government also needs to make sure that there's a competitive landscape so that investment is still attractive and still possible. And it's it's important to find a balance between those two things, between what allows the country to be competitive and attract growth, and what allows the country to actually seem to be being fair to its population and distributing the wealth in an equitable manner. And finally, where the pendulum sits between those two points, I think, is the tricky job that you have as an institution. And I think the sooner you can decide where that balance lies and you can communicate a clear set of rules, then you will find investment follows. What an investor does not like is uncertainty. He doesn't like goalposts that keep shifting and uncertainty, because he can't do his economic evaluation and say, well, if I invest my $1 million here, I'm going to get $1.2 million out next year. He needs to be able to make that evaluation in an environment where the rules are clear. He knows exactly what he's getting himself in for. Provided the rules are clear, he can make his own judgment assessment. And it's in situations where goalposts seem to shift that you find investors get very, very wary. And the nationalisation debate, security of tenure, constant strikes, even things like debates around transformation, what are the rules of the game? If those are moving targets, that makes people very jittery. So my advice to you would be, nationalisation isn't the right debate. How the country uses its resources to get the right competitive environment and to share the wealth fairly, set the rules, and then we can all play by the rules. But we don't want movement. In terms of the hospital conversion process, yes, we will meet those targets. The money is in our budgets to achieve those. It's about 100 million rand a year. We've shown we can do that. We accelerated it this year, and we're on track to do that. Home ownership. Hostels are not the problem at all. Hostels are working well, and there's a well-established sort of system to get those up and running. The challenge in home ownership is single-family units. A single-family unit costs somewhere around the 200,000 rand mark, assuming you donate the land, and that's very difficult to make the formula affordable for the average individual. So yes, people would all obviously love homes of that sort of sort, but making the economics work is still challenging, and I think many of the home ownership schemes that companies have run have actually proved to be a little bit of a white elephant. So I'm not saying we're doing nothing on the home ownership front. We are. We have built 1,100 houses. We do have a revolving fund where we continue to build more. But I think in terms of sort of a massive rollout of building thousands of houses overnight, that clearly is not affordable. So we need to find some formula between banks, construction companies and mines that actually contains that cost in a way which makes it affordable. I think somebody mentioned one of the previous presentations that individuals feel very uncomfortable in taking on huge amounts of debts or paying high rent. So that's something we need to keep working at very hard, I think. In terms of the employment equity of the F band is your very senior leaders in the company, and of course the challenge there that I was referring to is in particular it's the engineering skills, where there's just quite frankly such a shortage of people in total and of any colour in those areas. And of course, as soon as you do find good candidates, if you grow good candidates, they do get poached and they do job hop quite rapidly. And of course, the danger there, of course, is the company with the deepest pockets can buy them. The companies with the pockets that aren't quite so deep will end up struggling. But nevertheless, we need to keep filling the pipeline. You would have heard I mentioned in my presentation a number of times, the pipeline needs to be filled. The more we can actually keep those junior ranks filled with coming out of the bursary schemes, that, I think, in the long term will be the answer to this challenge. So, Chairman, I think I've covered just about everything. If you have any more questions, I'll be happy to take them.
Now let's thank you very much, and as we have indicated to the other presenters, this is not the last opportunity, and indeed we would also further study your document, and in terms of what you are still going to send us, if you can send it through to the committee, you know, section, to the committee secretary. We would be grateful. Let's thank you for availing yourselves, and the presentation made, as well as the interaction that you have had with us. As you would read our direction, is that we are really serious about the exercise that you have embarked upon, and that we want to see transformation taking place in the industry. Because to us it will answer many more questions that we have, and indeed efforts that are put in by various companies are very much welcomed. And, seriously also, we want a situation where you talk of real transformation indeed. For instance, I was thinking that and hoping that you would allow your team a space to talk to us. And we're not sure whether they are part of the team or they are a delegation that has accompanied you to this August house. So next time when you come, allow them space. I don't want to say to you now that it's indicative of whether you are affording people the powers that go with the titles that they hold, because we are very much sensitive around those areas, that you don't simply present faces to us. You actually show us in real terms what people are capable of. But you haven't done that for now, and, but in the next time, it would be interesting for us to hear. Because we go to your companies, and sometimes you have a situation where the CEO, Black CEO, would make an introduction, and the presentation is done by mine manager, who happens to be white. And then we've got no qualms about the color, but if you say you are transforming, then transform. Don't give us something that is not, you know, what we expect to see. And I don't want you to react. Your time is your time is over now.
Chairman, I just want to say that the reason I did all the talk was I want you all to hear just how seriously we take this, because
what?
Not all companies are sending their CEOs to these presentations, and it is important that you realize there is buy-in from the very top on these issues.
Of course. I mean, we really appreciate that. You are not the first CEO, what is this company that had its CEO here from these other presenters. They had their CEO here. But what I'm saying is that when you say you transform, transform. Show us that you are transforming. Because you came here accompanied by people that you said you have affirmed. But here in Parliament, they're not showing us that. So I don't want you to respond. I don't want an engagement. Take it as a message that we are giving to your company, that we, even when we go to Lonmin for oversight, we want to see things in reality, not just on paper. So I'm saying, for now, maybe it was because of time constraints that you thought that you would need to handle this, but we are saying this demonstrates something else to us as people who are expecting to see transformation in practice. And having said that, we're saying this is not the last engagement with you. We're still going to engage with you into the future. You would definitely come back to us, because we're going to request you to then come back so that we can finalize some of the, once we have listened to all the companies, and then we'll give you the verdict. Surely we'll tell you in your face if we believe you are not transforming. We will also tell you in your face if we believe that you are transforming. So this exercise is not tokenism. It's basically, you know, a serious engagement with yourselves to grapple with issues and find solutions. So yes, thank you very much for that, and don't come back less CEO next time when you come. Bring the CEO along as well, as you have done today. It's highly appreciable. It's really highly appreciable, because we're engaging with people that take decisions. That's what we want. So that when we agree on something here, we know that that will be implemented, because decision makers have been here. We have engaged them. Thank you very much. Honorable members, thank you very much. And let's go back to the house. The meeting is adjourned.